and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Kieran, back in the north again, are you now? How does that feel?
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I'm really looking forward to seeing some students face to face and getting back to the day job, which is what I love.
Yeah, and I imagine you'll be an enormous boon to the quinoa and fancy water economy in Liverpool as well.
certainly.
They'll be rubbing their hands together. Here he is. Crack out the fanciest water. Add a pound to the price tag. Later, we shall be hearing from Catherine Albany Ward, founder of Colourblind Awareness, in what for me was an eye-opening interview, which is kind of ironic, I suppose. But I certainly learnt some things. Catherine was going to make sure I learned some things, but it's a fascinating interview, and I guarantee that most of you will share my surprise at the impact that colourblindness has on individuals and on the economy of football. But first, some news, Kieran, and of course, Derby rumbles on. It will do for some time. Mel Morris has continued his Not Me Governor charm offensive, and Kieran, in a touch of nostalgia, our old friend Eric Alonso is back on the scene, and he's still talking bollocks.
He's talking completely out of his other orifice at present. he's put some stuff up to say, you know, the Illuminati are preventing a successful takeover, and the EFL are evil, and so on. None of which are true. So Mel Morris is trying to persuade people that he is completely innocent of what's, you know, he says, yes, I've made some mistakes, but it's COVID. But yeah. I think he used the word coercion from other clubs in respect of the EFL. And, the EFL have got a tough gig. You know, and we will praise them when they do well, and we will criticise them when they don't. But there isn't a vendetta against Mel Morris. You know, it's simply not the case. They are, ultimately, they are administrators. And they have protocols that they have to follow. But there's more and more stuff which is coming out. And I've got to say, as each piece of information is revealed, the greater the concern for Derby County. Yeah. Wycombe Wanderers are threatening to sue. We're not quite sure who they're going to sue, whether they're going to sue Mel Morris or Derby County or the EFL. In respect of, they said, well, had this taken place, had the administration taken place a few months ago, they wouldn't have been relegated. But also, one of the things that Mel said in his interview, that based on the revised calculations in respect of financial fair play, and this broadly ties into the numbers I'd calculated 2 or 3 years ago, that they would be looking at perhaps a 4-point penalty for breaches of financial fair play for the period 2016 to 18. And now, had that been applied last season, clearly Derby would have been relegated and Wycombe Wanderers would have survived. And Wycombe are now saying, well, we are worse off due to the fact that then, you know, that we know that there's a steep drop between the Premier League and the Championship in terms of TV money. The same is true between the Championship and League One, because clubs in the Championship get 80% of TV monies from the EFL, and clubs in the in League One only get 12%. So they're saying, you know, we can't have this parallel fixture list, which the EFL were proposing a couple of months ago. But we've suffered financially, so they are. Yeah, and this could be a bit of ambulance chasing from their legal advisors, from all we know, but that they are unhappy. There was a very detailed article in The Athletic, sort of summarising the extent of Derby County's debts, and there was a change in legislation which has just come through, which means that the tax authorities, previously they were on the lowest tier of creditors, now they're entitled to 100% of all tax owing since the legislation changed. The figures I've been given, we are talking somewhere, you know, low to mid 20s of what is owed to the tax authorities. So that would have to be paid. You've got football debts estimated around about 10 million. So, yeah, we've already spoken, you know, £35 million has to be paid 100%. Then a quarter of the remaining debts, of which I believe the unsecured creditors, in the region of 5 to 10 million, and then we come to Mel Morris himself. Now Mel Morris has got over £100 million lent to Derby County. If he insists on taking 25% of that, it means that the administrators are going to have to sell Derby County for a fee of around about £60 million. For a club which is in League One and doesn't own its stadium, that's simply fanciful. So it's really concerning as to where we are at present.
See, the Wickham issue illustrates, Kieran, the EFL's problem, because if I was a Wickham fan, I'd be absolutely 100% behind what they're doing. But of course, as the EFL always point out, they're looking after 72 clubs who all have different interests and priorities, and who all think they're the most important club in the EFL, don't they?
Yes, it is a classic case of trying to herd sheep as far as the EFL are concerned. They've got minimal resources because the clubs vote on the resources of the EFL. And of course, every extra pound that gets spent at EFL HQ is one less pound that's being distributed to the clubs. So Derby fans are going to push back on this, understandably. The Wickham, they were taken over a couple of years ago by a lawyer, so you know he will know his rights. And it could be that the claim will be against the football club, which is in administration, so they end up with 25% of something or 100% of nothing.
Yeah, there are two things I want to raise. One is about a group of people who are very important, and one is about an individual who less so, but maybe. And the first group of people is the Derby staff, who are obviously at the moment very anxious about the future.
Yes. I don't think the Derby staff have been treated particularly well. I think it's fair to say that we have been contacted by members of staff at Derby to say, you know, can we explain the position, because they are getting nothing from the club. And this sort of really goes back to the story broke on Friday night. The staff were effectively given an email, my understanding, to say, you know, turn up for work the following few days, but very little communication is coming from the leaders at Derby County Football Club. And that's a terrible thing, because you know, leaders are supposed to lead, and they are supposed to show initiative, and they are supposed to have a duty of care towards the members of staff. And you know, Mel Morris choosing to go on a charm offensive with the local press and prioritising that over his employees, I don't think is indicative of a person who has got the priorities right.
Yeah, it's not good for staff, is it? Every time they turn the radio on, they hear Mel Morris explaining exactly how it's not their fault, and they're still completely in the dark. The second person I do want to talk about, and I know there will be Derby fans saying we shouldn't be giving this man the oxygen of publicity, but he was an important player and potentially could still be an important player, and that's Eric Alonso. And essentially, in this bizarre statement he released, first of all, he said that he's going to be so honest he'll be prevented from buying a football club ever again, he thinks. Then he says it's not Mel Morris's fault. I don't care what people say, it's not Mel Morris's fault. It's people round him. So I'd be interested to know who you think he means. And his last statement is that the EFL, he knows for a fact, want to take over the club, which is one of the most bizarre things I've ever read in my life. And I've read some bizarre things, Kieran, trust me.
I've seen this message from him, which came out on Monday, and it's fantasy, it's fanciful, it's just causing additional distress. I don't think anybody would take it seriously, but if they did, you could understand people getting distressed. It, it's It's complete nonsense. He would have been very, very dangerous for Derby County because his plan was to borrow money to buy the club, or effectively get the club to borrow the money to buy Derby County. Now, we've seen that take place with Manchester United when the Glazers acquired Manchester United. Now, A, Manchester United are in the Premier League. B, Manchester United are a global brand and can generate huge sponsorship and kit manufacturing deals. And they've got a 75,000 capacity stadium. So at least Manchester United did have large amounts of cash coming in. We've also seen this take place with Burnley. And I think people are a little bit concerned with regards to Burnley, which, you know, I've always said have been a fantastically well-run club financially. But at least, again, they've got the benefit of Premier League monies. But to for his proposals in respect of Derby were very, very high risk indeed. He should not be let within, you know, 100 miles of a football club, in my view.
Well, this is my fear, Kieran, that in this statement in which he defends Mel Morris, which obviously puts him on Mel Morris's side, attacks the EFL, which he will think puts him on Derby County fan side. It worries me that this is a man who still thinks he has a part to play in the outcome of this terrible scenario. And obviously we'll be thinking that the club is available for a lot less than it was a few weeks ago when he was after it.
It could be acquired at a lower price, but I think we've got to be realistic. You know, who's buying Derby County, there's a very severe chance that they are buying a League One club because there's an automatic 12-point penalty for going into administration. There is a high probability of a further points deduction coming in respect of some of the financial issues. And, you know, the club a few months ago didn't have 11 players because, you know, so it had to cut its wage bill. So therefore, the players that it has recruited are effectively embargo players. So there's a limit as to what they can be paid, and they're on relatively short-term contracts. So, you know, you put all of that together. If Wayne Rooney manages to keep them up, it will be one of the greatest managerial achievements of all time.
And Eric Alonso doesn't strike me as a man who wants to buy a League One club, as it happens. I apologise to any Derby fans if you heard amusement in my voice there. It wasn't anything to do with the story. It was the fact that we're having to do this part of the pod on Zoom because my battery ran out on my laptop because a posh woman that's been working with Ali decided to go off with my charger last night in the way that posh people do. So if there are sound qualities differences, that's the reason why. But the reason I'm laughing is I'm able to see an ongoing battle between the Baroness and Finlay, because three times while Kieran was discussing that, the Baroness shut his door, and three times Finlay opened it again with a big smile on his doggy face. And he's currently winning, I have to say.
Yes.
And it's not just Derby, Kieran, I'm afraid, is it? Another Championship team in bother. And I believe, just to show I have been paying attention, they are the club with the highest turnover wage ratio in that division, which takes some doing.
It is. Yes, we're talking a sad story, sad bad news coming out of the Majdad. Reading's accounts, when I saw them, I calculated that they'd lost around about £85 million over 3 years, and you're only allowed to lose 39. So I was amazed at the time that the EFL hadn't taken things further, but clearly they were under a transfer embargo. And I think the EFL is taking a bit of a sort of a good cop, bad cop approach to clubs in breach of FFP. They don't want to go down the route of having to formally charge them and then convene a panel, and you know, both sides have to employ very expensive lawyers. So they're now trying to sort of go through a mediation route, and it looks as if Reading are going to accept a points deduction somewhere between 6 to 9. I think it could have been as high as 12 had it gone to a charge. And there is, you know, it's a bit like, you know, if you get nicked, sometimes if you, you know, if you do a plea, this comes from members of my family, so I can say this with some degree of confidence. Uncle Terry says, it's always a chance to meet some of my old mates, just going away for a while. And you get a shorter sentence. So this is the equivalent. But it does now mean that we've got two clubs potentially with significant points deductions, could be occupying the bottom two places of the championship. And, well, it's not football, is it?
It's not. Two things, Kieran. Before we discuss Reading's actual finances, the mediation route, it sounds fair and it sounds grown up, but to me, it also sounds like you're going to get a different outcome with each club you mediate with. And sometimes football fans want to know that the rules are the rules and they apply to every club under whatever circumstances, and that it might be galling for fans of other clubs to see a club going to the EFL saying, look, we're going to hand ourselves in. If you want, we'll grass somebody else up. But is there a way we can knock a couple of points off this deduction? And it seems to me that, yes, it is the right route, but also I can understand why fans of other clubs might be annoyed by it.
Yes, because it could be. Let's say that Reading do get 6 points and then they stay up on the last day of the season by 1 point, and people say, well, hold on, they should really have had 12 and my club's been relegated.
Yeah.
And we get to that position, which we've seen, with Wickham and Derby. Everybody's unhappy. And also that there's a slightly unease from my point of view that we're sort of entering the realms of some form of 3D chess, whereby clubs will delay coming to an agreement with the EFL because they know that if they get a deduction this season, they'll go down. And then at the start of next season, we'll arrange it now. And, that's an extra year with extra TV money and an extra year with a chance of getting into the Premier League. So it's imperfect, but
Well, also clubs could do the opposite to that, Kieran, and wait until April and go, well, there we are, we're 8 points off seventh. We're not going up. We can't go down even with a 12-point deduction. Let's hand ourselves in now and sort it out. And then basically there's no punishment at all then, is there?
Well, I mean, to be fair to the EFL, they introduced what was known as the Ken Bates rule. Now, I don't know who this was named after, but you may remember Leeds United got relegated to League One many years ago, and then the day they got relegated, Ken Bates said, "Oh well, we're going into administration, and we get a further points penalty, kapow." And the other clubs are saying, "Hold on." I'm not saying he's a wily old fox, but he's a wily old fox. So I think there is now a cut-off date beyond which you can't have such an arrangement.
Right. Okay. Tell us a little bit more about the details of Reading's finances. Who are their owners for a start off? And also tell us a little bit more about the eye-watering amount they pay out in wages for every £100 they get in income.
They've got Chinese old owners. John Majewski has passed away, and he was looking to move the club on. So they do have owners who and I don't want to go and fall into stereotypes here, who don't appear to be that familiar with football. And there's a picture of the owners that's gone up on social media, where one of them, I think they're knitting, or they're engrossed in their phone. They're not concentrating on the football. But then I suspect you could take a photograph of 90% of people at a football match, and at some point they're staring on their phone or they're picking their nose or something, which doesn't look as if they're fully engrossed in a match. They have overseas owners who have put huge sums into the club, but in terms of the wages, the wages for the last three seasons have been over £200 for every £100 the club's been generating.
Wow.
And they are paying in the region of 17, 18, 19 grand a week, which is high by championship standards. Not hugely high, but it certainly puts them well in the top half of the table. That automatically puts you at risk. They've also invested, £50 million in the transfer market, and we know that the transfer market is pretty tight in the Championship. So that was in the four seasons up to 2020. So yeah, an awful lot of money is going out on the talent, and they've not delivered in terms of delivering, you know, delivering playoffs or automatic promotion. So what I think we're now seeing from some club owners is what I describe as go stop, i.e., they gamble for a couple of seasons, and then they have to go and slam the brakes on in the third because of potential financial fair play issues. And again, it's not football. It starts to become a business game and all that type of nonsense. You know, that's not what we go to football for.
Yeah, and again, Reading fans now have that same sinking cold brick feeling in the pit of their stomach that Derby fans have as well. Is this the end of it, though? If the club and the EFL agree a 6-point, 9-point deduction, is that this story over, or did Reading have to adapt their behaviour in the future?
They will be asked to follow a business plan, and that will be monitored. I think the EFL are certainly showing teeth at present, which is good. But we don't know what's going to happen at the next EFL owners meeting. They might all turn around and say, well, actually, you know, it's happened to two of us. Yeah, could it happen to a few more? We'll go and relax the rules, which makes it very difficult for, you know, ultimately the executives of the EFL are employees, and they have to do what the shareholders say.
And one more question, Kieran. The Derby news crept out, sneaked out. You almost acted as midwife to the Derby news. If you encouraged it, you lured it out like laying a little bit of lettuce in front of a tortoise. Is there any significance in the timing? Because this seemed to come from a Telegraph journalist, again, rather than be announced by the club or the EFL. It seemed first of all to appear on social media before it was fully announced. Is there any significance to the timing? Is Derby related? You know, are they looking at Derby and going, right, this is the time for us to hold our hands up?
I think there'll certainly be less attention on Reading at present. So, yeah, it could be that classic good time to bury bad news, because the concern is, you know, is Derby County going to be able to pay the wages next week? Whereas we anticipate that's not going to be a problem to the same extent at Reading, because the club's not in administration and the owners appear to be funding the losses. Whereas, you know, Mel Morris, Mel Morris made his money through things like Candy Crush on you know, these games that you can play on the phones, and he's just gone uninstall, delete, and walked away.
He's still talking about a retractable roof over the stadium, though.
Yeah. Well, how he reckons he'll. I think there's actually some form of arena in Derby already. So how on earth he's going to make money for 330 days of the year? And what on earth the groundsman's going to say? Because, how chippy groundsmen are.
Oh, all of them. They're like sound men on the TV shows. They are the surliest people you can ever work with. So it sounds like, Kieran, to reassure Reading fans, on a scale of 1 to 10, this doesn't seem as bad as Derby, does it, for them?
No. It's significantly less severe, because there is a risk of having no Derby County, and I can't say that the same risk exists with regard to Reading Football Club.
Yeah, I wish we didn't have to say that. This week's Panorama show on BBC, Kieran, looked at the way football clubs treat academy players, and you have your own take on the economics of the academies, don't you?
Yes. Academies are viewed by some clubs as profit centres. And there's a problem in football in the way that where we presently stand as far as academies are concerned. The Premier League used to give to the clubs in the EFL something called solidarity payments.
Yeah.
And these were quite substantial sums. And initially the clubs in the EFL said, well, thank you very much. That's very kind. And therefore they got used to spending money at a certain level because they knew that these solidarity payments were coming in. And then the Premier League turned round and said, okay, we're not going to give you solidarity payments anymore unless you agree to something called the Elite Player Performance Plan, which effectively allows Premier League clubs to snaffle, I think is the technical word, any promising child who is at a at the academy of an EFL club at a set fee. And these fees are peanuts. So it was a classic piece of business manipulation by the Premier League. Give the EFL clubs a bit of cash. They then become dependent upon it, and he's just left the room again.
Fiddly gay now. Sorry.
The trouble is, he's very good at opening doors, but he's not worked out how to close them, which means that the Baroness has to do that job for him.
You're spoiled. You've got people waiting on you hand and foot. The Baroness just shut the door again. Yes, go on, Kieran, sorry.
So the EFL clubs really were between a rock and a hard place. You know, they were committed to playing budgets on the assumption that the solidarity payments were going to continue ad infinitum. And then the EFL gave them a take it or leave it choice. You know, either you agree to our terms, which means we can take your players, or not. So that's one issue. I think that the main issue in respect of the Panorama programme was twofold. First of all, do football clubs have a duty of care towards these children? And they are children,
yep,
who are taken on. Now, everybody knows 99.8% of the kids are not going to get through the system in terms of... and it has to be said that some clubs are absolutely fantastic. They give clubs who wouldn't, they would give players who would not previously had an opportunity to, so some of them have contracts with really good schools, private schools. The Category 1 academies are committed towards education because they will lose their Category 1 status. Are the kids completely focused on education? Because, you know, the big carrot of a successful career in football, which is very competitive, is put before them. Not always. You know, do many of the kids who don't come out of the system, do they go on to have successful careers elsewhere? Yes, they do. But there is still a significant minority of these people, of these young children, who... And here, you know, parenting issues. You know, there are other stakeholders involved in the welfare of these children who could potentially have done more. Could things have been better? I think they can. So that didn't reflect very well. And then there was a third issue in the show when it came to unscrupulous agents. And there was one agency, and there was one agent in particular who was exposed by the Panorama team. You are not allowed to have an agent under the age of 16 because you are a child. Those are the football rules. But what we are seeing, and again, you know, it's a minority, but we are agency or intermediaries is an unregulated market. There are agents going around spotting young players, and then the approach is, okay, I can't necessarily approach the player at the match in case, you know, there are some scouts here and I get reported, but they'll take a note of the player's name the child's name, which, yeah, we are talking about
absolutely
children.
Absolutely, yeah.
They'll take it, and then there'll be approaches made on social media, or what they will do is they'll do some detective work and find out about the family, and then it's gifts to the family in the form of, you know, it could be boots for the kid, it could be a PS5, it could be some cash. Yeah, you know, and the greatest thing about football, in my view, is that it is one of the few meritocracies in this country. You know, if you come from a certain background, you've got a far better chance of getting a job in legal, in finance, in politics, and so on. We all know that to be the case. Even in your profession, you think about the media profession, you know, there are people who come into the media because they have relatives who are in. In football, it doesn't matter how posh or how poor you are. If you can do it, you will be spotted and you will go through the system and you can become a professional footballer. So it's absolutely fantastic that it is a meritocracy, but it does mean that kids from more socially disadvantaged backgrounds, they are vulnerable to these predator agents. And that was one of the things which was exposed by the show. And I think everybody knows this takes place. How the FA and the other football authorities can deal with this is a real challenge, because nobody's got an incentive to dip in these rogues. You know, the players aren't going to do it because they could be up on a charge, or their parents could be up on a charge. The parents aren't going to do it because, you know, they could potentially have been financially, they financially may have benefited from this. And of course, the agents themselves, you know, it's a rough and tough industry. And some of them will say, well, this is how it has to be done, because it's an unregulated industry. There's a race to the bottom. And if I don't offer this kid a PS5, yeah, somebody else will.
Well, the economics is the problem. My industry, broadcasting in particular, is full of middle class and upper class people, because they can afford, or their parents can afford, to support them,
yeah,
in the early years when they're doing jobs that are either badly paid or not paid at all. And my guess is that in football, most of the kids are from family backgrounds where it's very easy for an agent to wave a bit of money in front of mum's face, or a PS5 in front of dad's face. And the sort of thing that doesn't come easy to them is being offered to them by an agent, and you can't blame them for having their head turned. But the problem is, as you say, there's nothing to stop the agents approaching the parents. They're not allowed to approach the kid, but they can approach the parents. And again, we have to keep saying kid. As you say, we have to keep saying child, because this is what they are. We're both at an age where we know that 18-year-olds are still kids, let's face it, let alone the 12-year-olds or the 8-year-olds that some clubs are dealing with. But this is an issue we will continue to talk about, because unfortunately there will be rogue agents in the game forever. And we have to acknowledge as well that most agents operating in the game are decent, honourable people who do so within the rules. But, you know, like everybody else, they're trying to make a few bob, as we are. And sometimes we bend the podcast rules, Kieran, mainly just to annoy Guy. But, you know... more problems with investors behind some of China's biggest clubs.
Yes. We've seen the winners of the Chinese Super League effectively go out of existence a few months ago. And now we have, and first of all, apologies with my pronunciation. I have been contacted, and this is what I love about our listeners. I have been contacted by some of our listeners to say that my pronunciation is poor, and I take
you,
it.
You and me both, mate.
Yeah. Especially with regards to my favourite Australian vampire bank, which should be apparently Macquarie. Macquarie. But this, and God knows how this is going to come out. This is Guangzhou Everglades, which is again a club in the CSL. And the way that Chinese football is operated is that most of the clubs there are offshoots of corporates. And that sort of, you know, takes me back to sort of, you know, the old Eastern European days, where, you know, we used to have all of those fantastic clubs in East Germany and Romania and so on. And
Carl Zeiss Jena. Carl Zeiss Jena. Yeah, yes. Of course. The optics factory, yeah.
So,
well, most Russian clubs belonged to a factory or the army or the KGB. So they were all subsidized by a particular part of the government back in the 60s and 70s, weren't they?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, for anybody that's got any football history and romance, that's fantastic. And that's okay if they're all state owned. But if they are private companies, there could be a problem, because Everglades' parent company has got $300 million worth of debt, which it's unable to pay.
Right.
So the first thing, of course, that you do is you turn the taps off of all of the parts of the group which is losing money. And at present in the Chinese Super League, football is a loss-making business. So I think sort of the rush to China, which was very significant 4 or 5 years ago, you know, there was one transfer window where CSL clubs spent more money than the Premier League, for example. Mm. That is in reverse. And I know the Chinese government, you know, the Chinese government, they don't worry about individual transfer windows. Yeah, they have a 10, 20 and 30 year plan with regards to football. But it does look that as if football is becoming less of a critical issue as far as the Chinese authorities are concerned, which is going to give them a problem if they want to host the World Cup at some point.
You know, I sometimes wonder, Kieran, or worry about the segue between news stories. You know, 1 minute we were talking about agents, and then suddenly I launched into investment in China. And now we're going from investment in China to me saying, hallelujah, Phil Collins is back at Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah, this is a really bizarre story. I'm not quite sure that it's within our remit. I think I tweeted it, so the producer guy has spotted this. Paris Saint-Germain used to come out to a song from Phil Collins' No Jacket Required album, which was, of course, a staple amongst all footballers in that particular era. And the song is called Who Said I Would? And then PSG decided they were going to change the song to which the players come out, and there have been protests from the PSG fan base that we want Phil Collins back, and the club has conceded. You and I are both from broadly the same musical taste, and me as a militant goth, and I'm sitting here proudly wearing my Sisters of Mercy t-shirt, as you can probably see. Phil Collins was the Antichrist to us, but I am staggered that there have been protests in for Phil Collins, but all other musical tastes exist, and clearly the sophistication with which I always associated Parisians has now completely evaporated.
Well, maybe being Parisians, it's an ironic postmodern appreciation of Phil Collins. Who knows? But the thing is, Kieran, as we know, football fans can be a conservative breed with a small c. Witness Mohamed Al-Fayed when he got rid of Diddy David Hamilton as Fulham's PA announcer, ex-70s DJ, and replaced him with Keith Allen for three games at the start of the season, and then got rid of Keith Allen because Keith Allen and his mates did an Egyptian sand dance before one of the home games. Lo and behold, Diddy David Hamilton was back. Football fans are used to what they like, what they're used to. They don't particularly like change. You know, there are still Palace fans who yearn for the days of the Palace dollies, 12 girls in old Palace shirts and skin-tight white leather shorts. But they're probably not nostalgia reasons, I have to say, for those. Kieran, I think every one of our listeners knows by now that you are colourblind.
Yes.
And to be honest, I've always in the past put that down as a quirky peccadillo, like being teetotal and supporting Brighton.
Yes.
So you arranged for me to talk to Catherine Albany Ward, founder of Colourblind Awareness, to explain the full impact of colourblindness on football fans and its financial implications. Catherine, it's lovely to meet you. Thank you for speaking to us. I feel slightly guilty, I have to say, Catherine, having done some research, because I went onto your brilliant site and one animation said, you probably haven't given these problems a lot of thought. And they were, I'm afraid, absolutely right. Until I met Kieran, I don't think it was anything I'd ever given any thought to. Is that a common response?
Yeah, and I'm guilty of it myself as well, because my brother-in-law is severely colourblind. And it wasn't until it directly affected my son that I suddenly thought, this is actually quite serious and I better apply my mind to it. So you're just like everyone else. I wouldn't worry about it.
I do. I'm very sensitive, Catherine. I do worry about these things.
But now there's no escape, because now we know, don't we, Kieran?
We do indeed.
that sounded really ominous. For those of our listeners who haven't done their research, Catherine, just give us an idea of some of the numbers and why you felt you had to found Colourblind Awareness.
So the numbers are quite shocking, really, if you've not heard about it before, because everyone thinks they know something about colourblindness. But it's not till you look into the implications of it that you realise that it's actually 1 in 12 males who inherit red-green types. There are other types as well, but I won't dwell on those at the moment. And only one in 200 women. So there are, I think it's one in seven women that are actually carriers of colorblindness and can pass it on to their sons. So one in 12 men is 8%. And if you add the women and the men's figures together, you come up just under 5% of people who are affected. But in sports like football, it's more, because obviously more men watch football than women do. So it's more like 6% or so of a stadium, a capacity stadium. So the figures we have for Wembley are about 5,000 people at a live game at Wembley would be colourblind.
So you say people think they know about colourblindness. All I really know is when Kieran told me early in our relationship that he could never be a train driver. And you sort of walk away thinking, well, that's not the worst thing in the world. But then as I learn more from Kieran, and Kieran, because we're here to talk about sport and finance, and just yesterday, Kieran, in the Brighton-Leicester game, you had an experience which is typical.
So Brighton play in blue and white stripes. Leicester play in something which, I don't know what the colour is. It's muddy. It could be green. It could be brown for a while. I don't really know what these colours are. And the referee and linesman, they were wearing shirts which were, the way to think about colour blindness is that if you look at things on if you were looking at them on a black and white TV, you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. Well, I couldn't tell them apart because they were some form of red or purple, and it was made worse by the fact that the referee and the Leicester team had black shorts. So, normally you're looking for something to distinguish. At one stage, why is the referee just nutmegged our left back? And of course, I just got it wrong. It doesn't stop you playing sport, but it slows you down when you're making a decision. And therefore, it impacts upon players as well.
Kieran, I wish I could tell you what colour Leicester were wearing, but obviously I don't watch it if Brighton win. So that's not an issue. And Catherine, it's not just kits, though, is it? Tell us about some of the other problems for the colourblind football goer.
Well, there are lots of issues in stadiums. We do stadium audits for UEFA to try and pick these up for their competition finals. It's things like not being able to see. When you're buying tickets, you have problems distinguishing which seats, which seat pricing you're looking at, the colours for that, especially season ticket pricing can be a problem, or selecting a ticket. You want to sit next to your friends and you can't work out which seats have been taken and which ones are free and that kind of thing. And then there's wayfinding information and stadium plans that cause problems, and also not being able to see emergency signage sometimes. And even just getting to the stadium, not even related to what's inside the stadium, something like a tube map causes big problems as well. So there's that side of it from the spectator's point of view. And then also on TV, issues with the graphics, being able to see whether or not somebody scored a penalty has been a big problem. Basically anything where colour conveys the information, and only colour, there's going to be a potential for a problem or two.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Do you know what, Catherine? I'm a very proud Londoner. I must have looked at that tube map virtually every day of my life, and it's never ever once occurred to me that it might be an issue for people who can't distinguish colour. And also, just talking now about emergency signage. So, as you say, at Wembley, there are 5,000 people who, in the event of an emergency, God forbid, would be struggling to discern where to go.
Yeah, I mean, you can do things about it, but because emergency signage is a green colour, that specific shade of green that's really similar to the colour of concrete to people with one of the most common types of colour blindness. So, yeah, it can effectively disappear against the stadium wall.
how many types of colour blindness are there, Catherine?
Well, there's three main types, and it's all to do with the biology of your eye. So in the back of your eye, you have cone cells that pick up signals from light wavelengths. And you have one that picks up blue colours, one that picks up green, and one that picks up red. And in colour blindness, one of the cone types doesn't work properly, or in more severe cases, you don't have one of the cone types. So, for example, my son doesn't have any cones in his eye that will pick up green light at all. But that also means that because of where the red and green elements of the light spectrum are, it's very close to where he would pick up red, and there's a bit of overlap, so he doesn't see red either. And that's the same for most people who are colourblind. They have issues across any colours, potentially, that have an element of red or green in. But the blue cone types is really rare. So the statistics I gave you were for the red-green types. And you can have a severe form of it or a less severe form of it.
In the past 20 years, thankfully, clubs have really upped their game in terms of disabled access, things like commentary for blind fans, quiet space for autistic fans and so on. Are they even aware there's a community of colourblind fans that need help?
Well, in the UK, they should be. European clubs should be as well, because we did the guidance for UEFA in 2017, and we did that in partnership with the FA as well. So that information has been out for quite a few years now. And the Premier League have also issued guidance with the EFL to all of their clubs on ticketing, on general stadium issues and issues on colourblindness in general. But most people that seem to be at the decision-making end of things don't seem to be receiving this information or understanding how it's relevant to them. So they should know, but they don't. I mean, we can see that by what happens on the ground and on the pitch and the number of kit clashes that there were just in the Premier League last year. The message isn't getting through at all.
Are clubs legally obliged to address the issue? Does colourblindness fall under disability legislation?
It does, in as much as if you put people in a situation where they can't see information, be it kits or whatever else, compared to most people, then it's a disability. But if everyone was watching in black and white, it wouldn't be a disability, right? Because they wouldn't be any more disabled than anyone else watching in black and white. So it depends on the situation. And I think half the problem is that nobody has the confidence to take on the clubs to say, you've discriminated against me. You know, the amount of money that they will be up against would put people off bringing a challenge. But obviously we receive lots of complaints from people who can't buy tickets and, you know, can't watch games on the TV. And it's the only way to really make change is not really through the legislation, which would apply. It's through persuading clubs and persuading competition organisers and leagues that they need to do it because it's the right thing to do and because it affects them at the end of the day commercially, which I know we're going to come on to talk to about, you know, the financial implications of it, I think have been completely overlooked, but it doesn't mean they're not there.
Well, that's the problem as well, isn't it? Because they don't think long term, because you not only have to persuade them that it's important, you have to persuade them that it won't cost them a fortune to make these changes. I know the answer to this next question, Catherine, because Kieran has told me quite a lot on a very regular basis. But are TV broadcasters and advertisers doing enough about colour clashes on TV, or will that only happen when thousands of colourblind fans start to cancel their subscriptions or stop watching?
Well, it's a difficult one for me to answer because I don't have those relationships with the broadcasters, although I'm starting to. I think if they realised what was happening, they would probably take steps to protect their financial interests. But I think that they also don't really realise what's happening either. So they might be aware that there are kit clashes, but maybe they're not making the connection that means that however many tens, hundreds of thousands of people are actually switching off and making their product, which is selling advertising at the end of the day, it's hitting that because they're not getting the number of people watching the matches that they think they are. And it will eventually have a knock-on effect if they don't do something about it soon, because people in the community who are affected are much, much more vociferous about it now than they ever were before. And the fact that we got really good coverage in the press, I know Kieran was involved in making sure that happened as well, for all of the Premier League kit clashes last year, the Premier League have now taken further steps to advise clubs, because I think they're frightened that broadcasters might take steps to interfere. I don't know, because I don't get involved in those detailed conversations at that kind of a level.
Well, Kieran, can I bring you in there? Because since knowing you, I've noticed how, Catherine used the word vociferous, I've noticed how much more vociferous the colourblind community is, for want of a better word, about these issues. But when will broadcasters start to do anything about it? And would there be a financial impact on them if many, many thousands of people affected stopped subscribing?
I think there would have to be some form of militant action, and that's not going to take place because it doesn't affect every match. And what we tend to do is we moan about it, but there are certain matches which I will simply just switch off because, when I'm watching match either live, if you go to a match and it's live, you're there, you've already paid the money, nothing can be done. If you are watching a match on television, I've always said I've not watched Wales versus Ireland for years because, in the rugby or the football, because it's red versus green, and it's just not worth the effort because you want to enjoy the match. You don't want to be staring at, intently trying to pick up flashes, from the socks or whatever. So I don't think broadcasters will, because colour blindness is treated as a joke by the broadcasters and by the broader football industry. What Catherine does is amazing, and my hat is permanently doffed in her direction. But I think we're sort of patted on the head and then told to go away and leave them to bring out the autumn lilac kit that which is going to get 8 out of 10 in the next review in the papers.
It's interesting to hear Kieran say that, Caffrey, as I think most football fans, and me included until a while ago, would have said, well, surely there's some way of telling. You must be able to tell two football teams apart. But quite clearly, many people can't.
No. And it's not always the colour combinations that cause a problem that somebody who only knows a bit about colour blindness might think would cause a problem.
Yes.
Really bizarre colours, if you don't know about it, would be an issue. So I can't remember who it was who played now. I think it was Leicester against Everton. About 18 months ago, one played in peachy orangey colour and the other team played in yellow, which were not their normal home kits at all. And colourblind people could not tell those at all apart. Even Gary Lineker got involved in that one. But it doesn't mean you can't solve the problem. And one of the pieces of advice that we give is, if you look at the two kits that are going to be played against each other, one, you have to look at them in grayscale, make a decision based on the grayscale element of the colours. And if you can't tell them apart in grayscale, which is what Kieran said earlier, then it's going to be a problem. But there's also a problem with the colour of the kits against the colour of the pitch. And one thing I've discovered is that kits get designed on a white background, which is hilarious when you think about it.
Oh.
How can they possibly think that's the right way to design kit colours? And the Premier League have software that works out whether there might be kit clashes. I know that other leagues will not have that, but I definitely know the Premier League does because we were involved in helping them put it together. And that looks at a digital version of the kits rather than actual real life colours. So when we looked at some of the kits, potential kit clashes in the FA Cup last year, we had to look at the real colours, not the designer's colour. And we had to look at it compared with the colour of the pitch. But it still isn't hard to do it. You just have to know what you're looking for and apply the sort of basic facts to the issue, which is if it doesn't work in grayscale, you've got to start again.
Well, that's ludicrous. I'm really taken aback by that fact, Catherine, because it's ludicrous that in this day and age, this with modern software that's space age, literally, they're still designing shirt colours against a white background. And the fact is, Kieran, as we know, nothing's red and blue anymore. These are just some of the colours that the kit manufacturers have for Premier League clubs. Rhapsody purple, collegiate navy, flaming amber, teal. And these are just designed to make more profit, Kieran. That's the problem, isn't it? All it is to try and buy new shirts for new fans to spend money on.
Yeah, yes, because the football kit business is big business. And Adidas pay Manchester United £75 million a year for the rights to be the kit manufacturer. So, you know, the issue we as colourblind people have with the Manchester United kits is that we can't spot the numbers. Yeah, we can work out. Yeah, we know that Luke Shaw is indifferent in stature to Scott McTominay and so on. But you don't do it instantly. It's all very well me saying this as a football fan. I don't work in the football industry, and it doesn't provide my income. But if you are a footballer who is colourblind, you are going to have to take a fraction of a second longer to identify one of your teammates. Now, football is a very fast sport. These colorblind footballers are being discriminated against. They are not able to carry on their trade to its utmost because of the condition that they have.
I want to come on to that more specifically. Just in a moment. But first of all, while we're talking about broadcasters, you did have some success with cricket, didn't you, on TV, Catherine?
Well, only a little bit, to be honest on that. We did get one of the cricket providers to change, they have these things called wagon wheels that tell you how many sixes went in one direction and how many fours and that kind of thing. And we did get them to change their graphics.
This was Sunset and Vine, wasn't it?
And I've been talking to Sky about that recently because it turned out that Ian Botham is colourblind. And when he was using the graphics on Sky, he would have a problem using those and he would have to hand over to David Gough. And actually nobody at Sky realised that they could have sorted that out for him.
Well, that's really interesting. I've got a history of Sunset and Vine. I used to do a live show for them years ago. Who was it you dealt with there? Can you remember?
It was Dylan Jane. I don't know if he's still there. It's quite a while ago now.
That makes me feel really old because he was the T-boy. On the show that I did. Sunset and Vine are a good company to work for. Did they make these changes reluctantly or was their attitude was, oh, my God, we just didn't know?
No, they were really good. And Sky are doing the same thing now. I had a conversation with Sky again last week. They are really keen to make changes. So I think we will see changes certainly in graphics because once one starts, they'll all do it. But the kits and issues for players, I think, is a different kettle of fish altogether.
Because, Kieran, I mean, the 100 cricket series we've just seen, the graphics on those were difficult enough for me to sort out. They must have been impossible for you to sort out, Kieran.
Well, I think there was quite a few things about those graphics which were difficult. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. But the colour issue, it was quite painful.
Now, Catherine, Kieran mentioned the difficulties for colourblind players, and we all know that he's using it as an excuse because he was quite a slow footballer anyway. but he makes a very good point. What can clubs do to manage the situation for colourblind players? Because they could be missing out on a lot of talent because it's not just shirts, is it? As well as bibs and cones and all sorts of things. So are there simple things that you recommend to clubs that enable them to retain the interest of colourblind footballers? Because we must lose thousands of young men, young women who are colourblind and just give up playing football every year, which is a disaster for their own physical and mental health as well, isn't it?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's more than one issue with the players. I mean, we've tried to raise the issue with FIFA Pro, and FIFA Pro said, yes, we need to support colourblind players, but there aren't any.
Oh, really?
So on it, you know, we don't know of very many. So I've literally went out of my way to make sure that I got EU funding for a project to research players. And just to put it in context, we've just started getting some feedback from our Danish club partner, and they've just screened all of their first team players. And surprise, surprise, they've got exactly the right proportion of players who are colourblind that we would have expected. That's ongoing. But in terms of players that we already know about, I don't know any players. I hardly know any elite players at all. But I know two players who played each other regularly in the Premier League in the early 2000s, regularly, both internationals, and both of them played each other in the quarterfinals of the World Cup in 2002. One of those players, and I won't name anything to do with the colours or the player or anything like that, moved. He was an international and he moved for a huge amount of money to a Premier League club. And it's well documented that that player, who then was went from a club playing in a colour he could clearly see against the colour of the pitch, went to a Premier League club where he would have had a problem as a colourblind player because their kit was too similar to the colour of the pitch, etc., etc. And his performance is well documented to have gone... Well, become it was well under where they expected him to be playing. Well, that's obviously going to be the case if he's going to have trouble with their kit. But he would have had problems in training. They all have problems in training with bib colours, with cones. It may mean that somebody who is a good player but has been faced with problematic training equipment or, tactics and that kind of thing, if you can't tell the colours of the magnets apart or whatever, might not get selected because he didn't perform very well in a training session because the coach didn't understand that he shouldn't be using certain types of equipment. And those types of equipment are things like red and orange cones and bib colours such as lime green and yellow are really trendy nowadays, but they both look yellow to a colourblind player. So if coaches were to understand and read the guidance that's already there, they could take simple steps to make sure that they are playing their best players to their best. And the coaches don't know about this either, even though the information's out there. So not only are clubs paying a fortune for their players that may not be able to cope with the kit colours sometimes, not only when there's a kit clash with the opposition or a kit clash with the match official or a kit clash with the goalkeepers, they might not even select them because they can't perform to their best in the training session running up.
Do you know, I don't think I know any football fan who would even believe that was an issue or would be prepared to give a player who's not playing well the benefit of the doubt for being colourblind. This is really illuminating, and I can't tell you how depressing it is, Catherine. I know so many people in football, senior people in football, who point blank refuse to believe that there are gay footballers. So to find out that there are people who point-blank refuse to believe there are colourblind footballers is even more depressing. Do we know how many colourblind referees there are?
Well, what I do know is, and this is something I need to be working on, which I am going to be working on soon, I do know that UEFA specifically will not permit people to be colourblind on a referee, so they screen them out. But also that is the case down through Premier League, and that's something I need to take up with PGMOL, because there are, with all the problem that Kieran's had this weekend, just give me more ammunition, really. If the match officials can't be seen from the colour of the players, that's not just a problem for somebody watching on the telly. That is a real problem for a player. And there was a player in the Euros who's colourblind, who played in all red against a match official in black. And I watched the whole game watching him. And every time he was supposed to be making a pass forward, he was constantly checking, where is the ref, where is the ref?
Wow.
And whenever he thought that, you could see he wasn't sure where the ref was because he couldn't pick him out from his own team, he would pass back or pass in a direction which you wouldn't have expected him to do. Every time he knew the ref was behind him, he'd pass forward. So there are all sorts of implications.
Those words, they screen them out. They're chilling, those words, aren't they?
Yeah, but the match officials choose the kits a lot of the time. So they're given their, I don't know what colour they give match officials to wear these days. They're just bizarre, teal and pink. Pink is a kit clash with blue. So the Euros final had Italy in blue and the match official in pink, so he just looked like another Italian player. Two of the Italian players passed to him in the final. So I don't know if there are any Italian players. Well, there will be Italian players who are colourblind. I don't know who they are, but I know that two passed back to the ref because I watched it about four times. But the match officials don't realise that they are actually disadvantaging one of the teams by doing that.
Wow. You mentioned your partners in Denmark earlier, Catherine.
Yeah.
Do other countries take this issue more seriously, especially in sport?
Wales are doing a really good job at the moment. So they have changed kits international level to avoid a kit clash.
Brilliant.
Yep. And Portugal we're doing a lot of work with. So they are using some of their main first team players as ambassadors for colourblindness. Bruno Fernandes is one of those. Good boy. So Portugal get it. And they've also had a first team player that they know was colourblind who speaks up about it. So, yes, there are changes. We also work with Iceland and they've got Lars Lagerbäck as their head coach at the moment. And Lars is colourblind. And so the Icelandic team, this is quite interesting. I don't know. I can't prove anything, but I found it quite interesting when Iceland beat England at the previous Euros, Lars was on their coaching team and he will not allow any equipment or any colours that would prejudice anyone who is colourblind. So he doesn't need to know who his players are who've got colourblindness because all the equipment and everything they do is suitable for colourblind people. you know.
But that's not only brilliant, but it's also simple, isn't it? That's the thing.
Yeah.
And inexpensive. And Finley's timing is always impeccable.
Finley does know the colour of the post office then.
Of course.
but dogs are colourblind, aren't they?
They are, yeah.
Dogs are colourblind, yeah. Catherine, it's been... I can't tell you how much insight I've gained from talking to you. I was prepared to learn a lot, but I had no idea that the problem was so widespread and deep-rooted. So one last question, and it sounds quite trite in the circumstances, but what are your hopes then for the future?
I'm hoping that the message is going to start getting through to the people who make the decisions and they realise that, you know, they can't give too little thought to the issues because it will come back and bite them because people, as I said before, you know, fans are getting more and more vociferous about what their rights are. So last year, I know that Man United were told, for example, by the Premier League that they were going to be in a kit clash game if they wore an away kit. And they thought, oh, well, that's okay. Instead of changing the away kit, we'll just, change the colour of the socks. So they changed the colour of the socks and it didn't make a blind bit of difference. And the next thing they found themselves over all the front page of the sports sections because they'd willingly created a kit clash situation. But they'd done that not realising the implications on their own colourblind players and their own fans. It was just somebody making a decision who didn't have the knowledge. So I think the first thing I would hope to happen is that people are interested enough to protect their own commercial interests by at least understanding the subject and how it applies to their specific organisation so that they can do better. And I think the more people do that, the quicker change will happen.
Catherine, it's been brilliant to talk to you. And as ever, if there's anything we can do on the price of football in the future to publicise or to gain new access to people, then we will happily do that. And I wish you all the very best.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Kieran, I don't think I've ever learnt more. We've done some brilliant interviews on this show. All of them are thought-provoking, insightful, but I don't think I've ever learnt more from one interview than I did from that, from Catherine, with an issue, as I said at the start, that most of us don't take that seriously. And I was astonished by some of it. There's two things in particular. There's one, in fact, we didn't cover properly, and that's the potential cost to advertisers of colourblindness.
Yes. So I am colourblind, along with one in 12 men.
Yeah.
And yes, it is a, but if I say to somebody I'm colourblind, the first thing that they will do is that they will point at a shirt and say, well, what colour's that then? How am I supposed to know? you wouldn't take a blind person to a zoo, point at a giraffe and say, well, what's that animal? And it's that equivalent. So it doesn't stop me doing anything apart from being a train driver. And I can't tell the difference between red and green. So traffic lights, bit of an issue. But, you know, but I always give a warning. Anybody that gets into my car for the first time, I give them a stamp. You know, I give them a formal warning that it's a bit of a lottery when it comes to traffic lights. But yeah, I'm still here.
I believe it's one of several warnings you give to people getting in your car for the first time, Kieran. But let's pass over that for the moment.
but if we take Manchester United's new away kit, which is blue-ish, blue and white bits.
Yeah.
Colorblind people cannot see the Team Viewer logo on the front of the shirt. It just blends into the background. So we've got no idea what's on the front of the shirt. And there's a separate issue that we've got no idea what's on the back of the shirt because the numbers, because everything's in red. And because of, you know, Catherine was saying it's all based on grayscale. Well, the grayscale of the blue on the front and the red is for us, it's indistinguishable. So, you know, I'm going, oh, God, isn't that good? United are no longer using sponsors. You know, that makes me hanker for the glory days.
Yeah.
But then you say, well, there's something on it, but it just looks a mess. So the sponsors are actually losing out because I've got no idea what it says.
So that means that they clearly aren't aware of this, because that means with the figures that Catherine gave us, if 8 to 9% of men, and it's mainly men as Catherine explained, if 8 to 9% of the people watching football can't see the sponsor, over the world, that's several million people not aware of the company that are sponsoring Manchester United, which is not good for them. And the other thing, I was seriously was so taken aback by this information that I started texting friends about it, who agreed. This idea that kits in this day and age of, you know, space age software, kits are designed on a white background. That makes no sense.
Yeah, it's but then, you know, the chances are is that if you are a clothing designer, you're not going to be colorblind, are you? Because how could I design something when I can't see that? You know, one of the things you take into consideration, fabric, style, well, color clearly is a critical issue. So it's like many of these things, they become self-selecting. You don't tend to get designers who are colorblind because we can't do it. It's and then I was staggered at the fact that the players' union are trying to say, well, there's no colourblind players. Well, and if that is the case, if they are true, then isn't that indicative of there is a huge problem? Because they've automatically excluded 8% of males from the talent pool. And I know the players that Catherine referred to. I absolutely respect their anonymity because you don't want the manager to know, you don't want the coaches to know, because you're competing against, you know, two other players for your place. And if they think that you've got a genuine problem and that could delay your decision making by half a second or so, they're going to play somebody else. So it's a really awkward issue. You know, it's similar to, you know, those people say, well, there's no such thing as a gay footballer.
Well, of course not, yeah.
That's just complete garbage.
Yeah, I have to say, Kieran, and you know this because you were there, at the end of yesterday's interview, I felt so bad about my previous light-hearted attitude to colourblindness that I felt I had to cleanse myself by telling Catherine that as part of one of my Edinburgh shows, I used to do a joke about a family who were so posh when their kid was diagnosed with colour blindness, they got him a guide dog whose job was to walk down the street going blue. And there was a slightly awkward 3-second pause before Catherine decided that she was going to laugh at that joke. I just felt I had to share that with her because I like I say, I don't feel ashamed, Kieran, because I never had the information at my fingertips. But with hindsight, again, like you say, somebody says to me they're colorblind, and instinctively you get a glass of orange juice and say what, and it's odd, and it's and the thing about emergency exits as well. That's the other thing, that there are people in grounds that can't distinguish emergency exits, and so many things that you just think, oh my God, it didn't even occur to me. And it was really interesting and really eye opening, and I hope people still Yeah, it's nice to include people, colourblind people, in jokes as well. But you know,
yeah. We don't take it. We don't get offended.
No. Yeah, I still think that you're using it as an excuse for not being a very good footballer back in the day, Kieran, I have to say. But
well, there was that, and being afraid of heading the ball, which I think both held me back.
Well, the balls were quite tough in our day, weren't they?
They were, yes. Yeah? Especially at half end.
Exactly. If the ball wasn't crossed towards you with the laces facing the wrong way, Kieran, you weren't going to head it. And thank you, as ever, to all of those of you who have contributed to our Always Free to Air pod via Patreon. That includes Rob Edgerton and Cameron Thompson, who says what you guys do has never been more important. Thank you. Also, Brent Hudson, who I like the sound of. Brent says, ultras often kick other fans out of their seats so they can bang their drum, but I'm more dullard than ultra, so I love the pod. I think that's a compliment. I'm not entirely sure. Keep up the good work. If you want to join Brent and Cameron and Rob, then go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have any questions for our regular questions pod on a Monday, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, while I entertain myself watching Finlay open the door, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran McGuire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks again, folks, for the feedback. Thank you for advising me of my poor pronunciation of words. I'm an old man, but I'm a great believer in lifelong learning. So I always take these things as a positive. Clearly, you know, Kevin has mentioned Patreon. If you want to support the show, that we're always very grateful. But if you just want to give us some good karma, you can do so by going on to that purple Apple icon, pressing follow. And if you can give a review, if you can give us 5 stars, it doesn't matter what you say. It's the stars that matter, not the words. So you can abuse us as much as you want. But if you give us the 5 stars, it helps the business side of things. It helps us in the charts. And yeah, that's always an issue for us. We are trying to book guests who are as diverse as we can from different parts of the football business. And Catherine, you know, the work that she's done with the football authorities, I think, is amazing. It just adds to our credibility. So thanks very much for that. And apart from that, look after yourselves. And to everybody who is working for Derby County Football Club, everybody in the football world is sending you love and positive vibes, and you know, just wishing that you get through this. We've had messages on the podcast from members of staff, asking us the questions that the club should be giving to you, and God willing, you will come through this. But best wishes to you all.
Hear, hear. The Price of Football. Price of football.